July 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a sobering new milestone in the U.S. fight against the coronavirus outbreak.
We're up to 4 million people in a matter of just over 2 weeks from the 3 million mark.
U.S. federal agents' recent use of force at protests are now under investigation.
Questions of whether the agents followed Justice Department guidelines, including identification requirements, the deployment of chemical agents, and the use of force.
Also ahead, Taylor Swift gives fans a surprise gift today. It's all on today's International Edition. The United States recorded more than 1,000 deaths from COVID-19 for the third day in a row on Thursday as the outbreak strained hospitals in several states. Johns Hopkins University reporting 4 million people now have been infected with the coronavirus in the United States. AP correspondent Tim McGuire reports.
Johns Hopkins University reports that confirmed coronavirus cases in this country are now more than 4 million. The hotspots include Sunbelt states from California to Florida. Florida reports 173 new deaths Thursday, raising the seven-day average to 121 people dying each day in that state. Governor Ron DeSantis insists even with hospitalizations and deaths on the rise, infections are stabilizing.
I think that that's part of that is the a lot of Floridians have done a lot of good stuff.
An AP NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds 9 out of 10 of those questioned wear a mask in public. I'm Tim McGuire.
With his poll numbers continuing to sink and coronavirus cases rising, President Trump Thursday reversed course, saying he will no longer hold part of the Republican Party's nominating convention in Florida in August.
We have to be vigilant. We have to be careful. And we also have to set an example. I think setting the example is very important. It's hard for us to say we're going to have a lot of people packed in a room and then other people shouldn't do it.
Trump had already moved part of the convention from North Carolina to Florida because of restrictions on gatherings due to the virus, but the latest surge led some Republicans to pull out of attending the event. Thousands of healthcare workers across Africa have contracted coronavirus, a fact that worries international health officials who say the continent's health infrastructure is strained enough without this added threat. In South Africa, the continent's epicenter, more than 3,500 healthcare workers have fallen ill and at least 34 have died. We hear more from VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg.
Nearly 770,000 people have been known to have contracted COVID-19 in the African region. And, says Dr. Matsidiso Moeti, the World Health Organization's regional director for Africa, buried in those numbers is a key group that is on the front lines of the battle.
In the African region, more than 10,000 health workers have been infected with COVID-19. One of the biggest challenges in protecting health workers has been the global shortage of personal protective equipment, which has severely affected countries on the continent.
Moeti says more than 2 million items of PPE, including masks, goggles, and gloves, have been shipped to African countries so far, with many more in the pipeline. According to Ghana-based midwife Dr. Jemima Dennis-Antwi, the health workers getting sick aren't always the obvious ones. Of the more than 2,000 infected health workers in the West African country, a significant portion are nurses and midwives.
Over 410 nurses and midwives have been affected in Ghana on duty. And this is because, of course, we are designated to serve our patients 24/7. The increasing numbers of infectivity among health professionals, coupled with limited or lack of consistent supply of resources, as have been stated, result in refusal to attend to patients, psychological stress to self and families, constant threats of industrial actions among many in countries. These, as we all know, have serious implications for quality care, especially reproductive, maternal, newborn, child and adolescent care.
Experts are calling for more protective equipment, for greater testing for health professionals, and for some common sense solutions. For example, Dennis-Antwi suggested that healthcare facilities should provide meals for on-shift workers to keep them from leaving the grounds to seek food. In Sierra Leone, officials are thinking even bigger, says Health Minister Dr. Alpha Wuri. In coming weeks, the nation plans to roll out a health insurance plan for all health workers. Most of the continent's affected health workers are in South Africa, the continent's viral hotspot. But Moeti said epidemiologists are seeing COVID-19 spreading to health workers in Algeria, Kenya, Ghana, and Ivory Coast. She says governments are reacting to the influx of data to avoid harsh measures such as complete lockdowns.
We've seen some countries, Cote d'Ivoire is an example, really use the data to adjust the response, if you like, lockdown locally where it's necessary to enable life to continue and the economy to open up in other localities. I think that one of the most important things to do is to really enable people to grapple with the challenging circumstances and play their role in limiting the spread.
That, she said, is the best strategy. Wear a mask, wash your hands thoroughly and often, and keep your distance. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Two U.S. federal watchdogs on Thursday launched probes into the use of force by federal law enforcement agents in Portland, Oregon, and Washington, D.C. during recent protests against police violence and alleged racial bias in the justice system. Security forces have frequently tear-gassed and clubbed demonstrators during weeks of unrest. AP correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
Local authorities in both cities have complained the presence of federal agents has exacerbated tensions in the streets. In Portland, Mayor Ted Wheeler has been among those tear-gassed, and federal agents have been accused of whisking people away in unmarked cars without probable cause. In Washington, investigators will look at the training and instruction provided to agents who responded to protest activity at Lafayette Square near the White House. Among questions are whether the agents followed Justice Department guidelines, including identification requirements, the deployment of chemical agents, and the use of force. Ben Thomas, Washington.
As protests for racial justice and police reform continue, President Trump, despite the pushback, has ordered more forces to deploy in cities across the country. VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to Professor Andrew Crespo, who teaches criminal law and criminal procedure at Harvard Law School in Massachusetts, about the legality of the deployments.
It is unusual for federal law enforcement officers to be taking the lead in keeping order in our cities. And that might seem strange around the world, but in the United States, it gives people some real pause to even see federal law enforcement officers out on the streets. It gives people particular pause to see federal law enforcement officers dressed in combat fatigues and really, to our eyes, indistinguishable from soldiers out on the streets of our cities. It's something we're not used to. We're used to having our local police departments and our state police be taking the lead in this situation. It's something we're really not used to seeing when our state governors and local mayors are saying, please, don't come in here to the federal agents, and the federal agents are there. I won't say it's unprecedented. There are certainly instances of federal law enforcement going into states where the states don't want them, but it's a dynamic that our federalist system really sort of makes these issues in really sort of stark relief.
So acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has come out pretty strongly on this issue. He said, quote, I don't need invitations by the state mayors, or state governors to do our job. We're going to do that whether they like us there or not, end quote. Is that legal?
We should understand that at least at face value, what he is saying as to the authority of federal law enforcement to even be in Portland has some merit to it, right? There is a federal courthouse in this city. It's federal property, and it's not just federal property. It's a key institution of the federal judicial system. It's the federal court in that city. And it's clearly been vandalized. It's not really that controversial here to say that the federal government can protect federal property or prosecute people who are vandalizing or attacking federal buildings. The question is, how far beyond that primary mission of protecting the federal courthouse are these essentially paramilitary officers going? Are they really there to protect the federal property, or are they using that as a toehold to try to essentially displace the local police, or at least, you know, do much more broad and sweeping law enforcement actions to address what the federal government clearly perceives to be lawlessness in Portland? And we get mixed messages from Secretary Wolf on that, because he certainly, you know, he knows that his legal authority is tied to protecting this courthouse. So he says that a lot. But then he also, you know, frequently speaks in these sweeping terms about, you know, lawlessness in Portland, talking about how, you know, how much damage there's been to the city. It's not his job to police the city. In fact, he has no authority to police the city. That's a tension that's a sort of a gray line in our law. How far how far does the primary mission that he has asserted of protecting federal property, how far does that stretch?
Professor Andrew Crespo, who teaches criminal law and criminal procedure at Harvard Law School in Massachusetts, speaking with VOA's Jason Patinkin. As Israel battles a second wave of COVID-19, protests against the government's alleged mismanagement of the crisis are gaining strength. Tens of thousands of young Israelis are taking to the streets, many demanding that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu resign. Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
The demonstrators are mostly young and they are angry. Many blame Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the coronavirus health and economic crisis, with some dubbing him the crime minister.
We have a very corrupt prime minister and we want him to go home. It's clear that the only crisis here is political. It's being managed for personal interests and out of a personal viewpoint, and it's killing the country. He's taking us down with him.
Along with Netanyahu's political opponents, the protesters include various sectors of the population who are suffering severe economic hardship during the crisis. They are demanding financial help.
And even if it's not a grant, then at least like the European countries give them a loan. We are not able to have a loan even. So something needs to happen. And whatever comes out of Jerusalem, whatever comes out of the Knesset, it sounds so disconnected.
Netanyahu has continually promised to extend unemployment benefits, compensate businesses, and distribute stimulus grants. But many have not received these benefits and do not believe Netanyahu's promises. They accuse him of only being concerned with his ongoing corruption trial.
We have just one prime minister who thinks only about one thing, which is how to escape the trial and the charges. The vast majority of the people, including those who voted for him, do not believe a single word he say. So this is a leadership crisis to begin with. This has to be, he has to be resigned or to be moved aside.
Israeli analysts say the pandemic has challenged young people's faith in the future. Overall unemployment in Israel is more than 21%, and among the youth, it's closer to 30%.
Now, the corona crisis generated, of course, a loss of jobs and opportunities, and many of the plans that these young people had, if it is travel or studying or earning money for something they wanted to achieve, if it's an apartment or something else, then this has evaporated in a very short period of time, and they are very frustrated about that.
Emotions are high, and the demonstrations have often ended in violent clashes with the police. But the protesters say they will not leave the streets until they see real changes that will help them weather the pandemic. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
With the end of France's coronavirus lockdown, African migrants who had been housed in state-organized accommodations are now once again living in tent camps north of Paris under dire hygiene conditions and high exposure to COVID-19 and other illnesses. Paris-based journalist Catherine Field joins us now for what has been happening there. Catherine, what exactly is happening with these migrants, mostly from Horn of Africa?
Right at the start of the pandemic here in Paris, the authorities went through all these camps that had been springing up around the capital and took all of the people there into accommodation. It was all state-organized accommodation. They were kept safe. They were given food. They were even given medical treatment. But once that initial very heavy lockdown ended after 7 weeks, the authorities said, well, you can go back out now. We are not under no obligation to house you. So we're now seeing around a dozen of these small tent encampments being set up around the capital, mostly to the north of Paris. And some of the bigger camps, we're seeing about 1,000 people. It's creating a lot of problems, not just for the community of volunteers that work there, that distribute meals to all of these people. But also there are, of course, health concerns. In these areas, you've got people living side by side. You've not just got these migrants who are predominantly from the Horn of Africa, countries such as Somalia, Sudan. You've not just got two of them living per tent. You've also got them living in areas where there is a real lack of space. And so there is the health problem. We've had just in the last week, 4 cases of COVID from these migrants who are living in tents. So it's a real problem. The government is sending health workers in to help out, providing water fountains and portable toilets, but the facilities just aren't there to be able to give these people more help in this time of year. It's quite hot here. It's summer, it's scorching summer heat, and there's just no shelter for these migrants.
I understand also that separately there's an issue with unaccompanied minors, immigrants, mostly from West Africa. What is happening with them?
This is a completely different, if you like, issue for the French government. Since about 2010, 2011, you've had this real wave of unaccompanied minors coming into Europe. And it's been several NGOs that have now got together, and they've got this new publicity campaign, if you like, going right in the center of Paris, Place de la République, where they've set up a whole range of tents, about 100 tents in the center of Paris, and there, that is now home to some 75 young people. All of them say they are aged under 18, mostly from Côte d'Ivoire, Guinea, who say that their application for legal protection from the French state has either been rejected or it's still in the works, it's in abeyance. So they're not yet at a stage where they're able to be cared for by the French state. Now, these NGOs say that the French state has got a responsibility to these unaccompanied minors, that they're covered by the International Convention on the Rights of the Child, and that France has to look after them. Now, the next question is, are these really unaccompanied minors, or are they just making it up as they go along? But generally, what we're seeing is you do look at them, and a lot of them are quite young. I mean, they're predominantly men. And when you talk to them, they do all have stories to tell of fearing persecution, of having escaped conflict in their home country. And really,
if they weren't in this tent village
that the NGOs had set up, they would be sleeping rough on the streets of Paris.
What is French President Emmanuel Macron and his government saying or planning on doing about any of this, if anything?
The French government says that they are working through the United Nations, through UNHCR, to help unaccompanied children. That is the way they're doing things. They say that France, within the next week, is going to accept 350 children, unaccompanied children from those overcrowded camps in Greece. There's some 1,600 children that are being brought out of Greece into 7 European Union member states. And France says that is where we're going to be working, through the UN and helping the most vulnerable people.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. A UN program is calling for a guaranteed temporary basic income from nearly 3 billion of the world's poorest people to shield them from the worst impact of COVID-19. The proposal argues the financial aid would help slow the spread of the pandemic by enabling impoverished beneficiaries to stay home. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations Development Program says that 1 billion people live below the poverty line on $1.90 a day. Nearly 2 billion others live just above the poverty line, but are at risk of falling below. About 70% work in the informal sector. They are self-employed, unpaid, and not protected by any social insurance scheme. Despite COVID-19 lockdown measures, people who work in the informal sector are forced to leave their homes to eke out enough money to support themselves and their families. UN Development Fund chief economist and lead author of the report, George Gray Molina, tells VOA their prospects of weathering the current crisis without a guaranteed income are bleak.
What we'll see is quite horrific. It's people with no jobs, no livelihoods, no income, with containment policies that are variable. Some are working, some are not working. If they don't work, then you see the spread of the virus. It gets worse and worse. So it's a vicious cycle, and this can be part, we think, of breaking that vicious cycle.
The UNDP estimates $1.2 trillion would be needed to provide a temporary basic income for nearly 3 billion of the poorest people in 132 developing countries for 6 months. Molina notes this sum is nearly equivalent to the $1.3 trillion of what developing countries owe in external debt payments this year. He says one way that countries could pay for the temporary basic income, or TBI, would be to defer payment of their external debt for a year.
The Secretary General of the UN has called for a comprehensive debt standstill, which would include, you know, all private creditors and also official bilateral creditors. So that's one source that we think could work. It's a standstill for 1 year, so you'd stop paying the banks for a year, but then you would restart paying the banks as soon as the TBI is over.
Several countries already have taken steps to introduce a temporary basic income. For example, UNDP reports Togo has distributed more than $19.5 million in monthly financial aid to nearly 13% of the population through its cash transfer program. Women who work in the informal sector are the main beneficiaries. It says Brazil and Colombia recently began registering people as a prelude to receiving financial aid. It adds that Spain recently approved a monthly budget of $289 million to supplement the incomes of 850,000 vulnerable families and 2.3 million individuals. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Korea is cracking down on activists who send anti-Pyongyang leaflets into North Korea. The crackdown is being criticized by rights groups who say Seoul is stifling free speech in order to placate North Korea. VOA's Bill Gallo has the story from Seoul.
Eric Foley has for years floated balloons and bottles full of Bibles into North Korea.
What we know is that they often will interdict on bridges.
Today, the Christian activist is driving toward the North Korean border. In his car are dozens of Bibles he's trying to float upstream into the north. But just ahead of the launch site, he's stopped by police and several local residents who are physically blocking the road.
So under what authority is the launch being stopped?
Police say they're stopping the launch because the locals are worried it will raise tensions with North Korea. It's part of a broad campaign by South Korea to stop NGOs from conducting launches after the North complained about them last month. While Foley is only launching Bibles, other groups are more provocative. Run by defectors, the groups often send balloons with provocative materials that ridicule North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Citing the leaflets, North Korea last month blew up the de facto inter-Korean embassy and threatened more military action. South Korea's response was immediate and fierce. It raided some of the group's offices, filed criminal complaints, and even revoked the NGO licenses of two of the groups, complicating their ability to raise money. The moves were strongly criticized, including by Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch.
We find it really quite astonishing. That's a pretty clear violation of freedom of association.
Robertson and others are particularly shocked at the timing of South Korea's crackdown. It came after Kim Jong-un's sister, Kim Yo-jong, called defectors human scum and mongrel dogs.
Rather than kowtow to, you know, Kim Jong-un's sister, South Korea should be standing up for its own principles. It should be, you know, demanding Pyongyang open, uncensored, and unrestricted channels of communication between people across the 38th parallel.
South Korea is undeterred, though, saying the crackdown is meant to reduce tensions. For Seoul, it's a matter of different priorities. A source close to South Korea's presidential office told VOA bluntly that for now, the priorities are peace, denuclearization, and the prevention of military tensions. Human rights, he said, come second. Many South Koreans agree. This Seoul business owner, Park Young-man, says most people actively oppose the launches because they interfere with inter-Korean relations and are dangerous. But the launches are protected in principle under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's according to Thomas Ojea Quintana, the UN Human Rights Envoy for North Korea. He told VOA that he is asked to meet with Seoul over the issue.
The South Korean government, instead of putting the defectors under pressure and stress, should be, on the contrary, offering them, you know, security and safety. This is, for me, is very clear.
It's not even clear South Korea's strategy will work. According to local media, there have been at least three successful balloon launches since late June. Many of the groups say they have no plans to stop. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
VOA's International Edition continues. The summer space race to Mars begins while a satellite snaps pictures of the sun in ways Earth-based cameras can't, and a comet NASA calls a natural firework streaks through the skies again. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us This Week in Space.
American astronauts Bob Behnken and Chris Cassidy taking a spacewalk this week to switch batteries outside the International Space Station.
Copy, Chris.
It was the duo's fourth spacewalk in a month. Each have completed a total of 10 spacewalks, tying the U.S. record. In less than 2 weeks, Behnken and Cassidy will leave the ISS aboard the same SpaceX Dragon crew capsule that brought them in May. It will be the first splashdown off the Florida coast in 45 years. SpaceX joined the history-making week with a record-setting turnaround speed to relaunch the same Falcon 9 booster that sent astronauts Behnken and Cassidy to the ISS. The booster carried a South Korean communications satellite and successfully landed aboard a drone ship called Just Read the Instructions. Meanwhile, the European Space Agency and NASA have released the first images of what they call campfires on the sun. The images came from their joint mission called Solar Orbiter.
We're going to be able to, for the first time, image the polar regions of the sun. So it's going to go close to the sun, but it's also going to go above the poles. And so we're going to be able to see the magnetic fields and the flows on the polar regions, which we've never done before.
Project scientist Holly Gilbert says Solar Orbiter's proximity to the sun more accurately measures the star's weather than do cameras on Earth.
By imaging and being able to observe the polar regions, we're going to be able to understand more about what's happening inside the sun as well. It's going to be really exciting when we first observe the poles because we don't know what we'll see.
Gilbert adds the closer images may help researchers better understand how the atmosphere outside the sun is hotter than its surface while also providing a clearer understanding of weather conditions on or near the sun. This could help safeguard air travel and wireless networks on Earth. In other news, the United Arab Emirates recently launched a rocket from Japan to Mars, marking the Arab world's first interplanetary mission. Expect the craft to reach Mars in February of 2021, marking 50 years since the formation of the UAE. China also started its summer road trip to Mars with its launch of an unmanned probe. It is the country's first independent mission to another planet. The probe should begin looking for a soft entry point through the planet's atmosphere in February on its mission to search for signs of water or ice. Finally, this week, the comet C2020F3, better known as NEOWISE, streaked through the Swiss skies. After disappearing from view July 23rd, NASA says it will not be seen again for 6,800 years. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Taylor Swift is giving fans the gift of a new album release today. The pop star making the surprise announcement Thursday on Instagram. Folklore, her eighth record, comes less than a year after her last wildly successful album, Lover. Swift says she wrote and recorded all the songs while in isolation, reflecting on her dreams, fears, and musings. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Is it chill that you're in my head? Cause I know that it's delicate. Is it cool that I said all that? Is it too soon to do this yet? Cause I know that it's delicate.